You're flying home from a golf outing with some friends on a beautiful starlit night, when bit by bit, things electrical begin to fail. Ultimately, you can't even hear ATC, and you're left with only a flashlight and a paper chart to figure out where to land. You've got problems. But the biggest is that you're headed right for the most restrictive airspace in the country, Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Capitol. How a pilot handled this very situation is the subject of this episode of I Laughed. I learned about flying from that. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 72 of Flying Magazine's I Learned About Flying From That podcast, brought to you by Avemco Insurance. I'm Rob Ryder. Losing situational awareness because of a total electrical failure at night can be frightening, especially when you're near the nation's capital. That's not a place to be without a clearance, an operating mode C transponder, and direct communication with ATC. That is, unless you want to risk having an F-16 become your escort. We'll hear how things worked out for Dr. Victor Vogel right after this message from Avemco. The folks at Avemco Insurance are passionate about pilot safety. That's why they sponsor the FAA's Fast Team Wings program, publish dozens of articles on safety techniques and human factors by noted CFIs, and even support I Learned About Flying From That. Visit avemco.com/flying or talk to them at 800-338-8705. Tell them that you're an I Laughed listener, and they'll even save you an additional 5% off your premium. Now, I Learned About Flying From That. My guest today on I Laughed is a retired physician who let flying get in the way. He's a CFI, a CFII, an instrument ground instructor, an advanced ground instructor, and is a member of the National Association of Flight Instructors Board of Directors, and he's got a very interesting story to share with us. Victor Vogel, welcome to I Laughed.
Rob, thanks for having me. It's a delight to be here.
It is a delight to have you, that's for sure. As a retired doctor, we've sometimes heard that doctors make bad pilots, but I don't think that's the case in your career. But tell us a little bit about developing your medical career and how that led to flying and then ultimately to your I Laughed incident.
Well, I used flying, Rob, as my form of recreation. And so I got my private ticket at the Martin State Airport in Baltimore and shared the runways with the A-10s of the Maryland Air National Guard.
Cool.
And then did a two-year stint in the public health service in a very small rural hospital, 30-bed hospital in West Virginia. And during that time, I got an instrument rating. And then I began my academic career and went to a large cancer center in Houston, the MD Anderson Cancer Center.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, it's quite a place, and it was a great place to start a career. I spent 10 years at MD Anderson, and during that time, I went to Hobby Airport and mixed it up with the Southwest Jets and got my commercial certificate at Hobby. So there I was. I had private instrument commercial. But then my career and family kind of got in the way. We had two children, and I was very busy with my clinical research career. But by 1998, I bought my first airplane. I rented a number of airplanes. There was a great aero club in Houston, the West Houston Aero Club, and I flew there many, many hours in many different airplanes, a Cardinal, a 182, an Arrow, and built my time. And then got to Pittsburgh in 1996 as the director of the breast cancer program at the University of Pittsburgh. And in 1998, I bought my first airplane, which was a venerable 25-year-old Beech Sierra.
Wow.
A delightful airplane.
Yes, it is.
A retractable, and I flew that airplane a lot for work.
That airplane's a lot like an Arrow, I think, isn't it?
It's very much like an Arrow. I've flown an Arrow for a number of hours, and the Sierra was a wonderful airplane. And where I learned to fly at the Martin State Airport in Baltimore was a Beech Aero Club. So I was in sports and sundowners and a skipper, But they also had a Sierra. And I had flown the Sierra actually from Baltimore all the way to Kansas and back. I knew it was a very capable airplane, easy to fly, very similar to the many hours I had in the Sundowner. So that was my first airplane. And I put hundreds of hours in that airplane. And that's the airplane that we're going to talk about for the incident that occurred.
And interspersed with this, you had a long time at Johns Hopkins in that system.
I had 10 years in the Hopkins systems, but then 10 years at MD Anderson in Houston, 13 years at the University of Pittsburgh. Wow. Then I had a brief stint as the National Vice President for Research at the American Cancer Society in Atlanta, and kept my second airplane, a Cirrus SR-22, at the Peachtree DeKalb Airport, which was a busy, busy general aviation airport.
And right on the edge of the Class Bravo of Atlanta Hartsfield.
Yeah, and when I went there from Pittsburgh, I got myself an instructor, and he kind of gave me the ins and outs of the Class Bravo airspace in Atlanta. But it was curious, whenever I would fly, west or southwest, mostly the controllers would take me right over top of Hartsfield Airport, which I guess was the best place to keep me out of the way from the rising and descending Delta jets that came in and out of Hartsfield.
I have done that very thing.
And I always thought it was rather peculiar. Here I am on top of Hartsfield at 6,000 or 8,000 feet and just happy as a clam and nobody's bothering me. It's wonderful.
Let's go ahead now and talk about what happened in your airplane. This is how long ago, and explain to me what the trip was, where you were, how high you were, and the fact that what happened was pretty serious.
It was kind of serious. Go back to my Johns Hopkins days. Three of my Johns Hopkins fraternity brothers were pretty good golfers, and the four of us used to get together once a summer, and we'd head off to someplace and play 4 days of golf. We'd play around a day for 4 days. And this particular year, it was in 2004. So it was July of 2004. We went to North Carolina, and I had landed, flew my Cirrus there. I mean, my Sierra there.
Okay.
And I had picked up one of my fraternity brothers who was an attorney, lived in the Washington, D.C. area. I think at the time he was living in Arlington, and picked him up at Manassas Airport and flew him to Fayetteville to join the other two fraternity brothers for 4 days of golf. And the last day was a Monday, and the weather, this was July, so the weather during the day in the late afternoon, there was some thunderstorms that were developing in western North Carolina and western Virginia. So we watched those on the FBO radar and delayed our departure. We had hoped to leave about 5 o'clock, but we delayed our departure till about 7 or 7:30. And, the sun was setting and it was a beautiful, clear summer evening, and the thunderstorms had moved off to the east, and we were well on the west side. And we had a beautiful flight at 7,000 feet along the ridges and headed from Fayetteville up toward Manassas. And as we traveled north, time went on. It became 8:30, 8:45. Sun went down. We're flying in the dark. But I was instrument current. I was night current. I had hundreds of hours in the Sierra, and I felt very comfortable. But as we approached, and now this is 2004. This is post 9/11. And at the time, that airspace was called the ADIZ, the Air Defense Identification Zone.
Manassas is right in it.
Is right in it. Now, of course, the SFRA, but at the time, it was the 80s. So I'm talking to the controllers, and I had gotten a very good weather briefing, and I knew weather was not going to be an issue. And as we were traveling north, at one point, I think we were about 45 minutes from landing. The autopilot seemed that it wouldn't hold altitude anymore. It would hold the heading, but it wouldn't hold the altitude. And then there was a series of losses. We lost one thing after another on the panel, And the controllers at one point said, well, we've just lost your transponder, and I could still talk to them. And then the controller said, this is probably Potomac Approach Control. They said, well, we can't hear you anymore. And then there was this progressive loss of things on the panel. And over a period of about 15 or 20 minutes, we lost transponder, we lost the autopilot, we lost the cockpit lighting, and then everything went completely dark.
Were you seeing at that point when you started to lose things, were you seeing a discharge indication on the alternator, or what was that reading?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't remember, and I probably was a little remiss in not looking at the ammeter as a regular part of my scan. And in retrospect, now several thousand hours later, you know, it should have been obvious to me what was happening as things started dropping off sequentially, and we just lost more and more of the electronic equipment in the airplane.
You had told me that it was a beautiful night. Were you VMC or IMC at that point?
We were VMC, very much VMC, with light winds, and all the clouds had moved off to the east. And there must have been 30 or 40 miles of visibility. There was very little summer haze. It was a very pleasant, kind of coolish, warm summer evening. And so we had great visibility. And we, while we were talking to the controllers on an instrument flight plan, we were in very good VMC conditions.
But still clear of what the eight is at that time. Now, what is the CFRA?
Right. And so at about the time I finally understood what was happening, my last recollection is we were about 16 miles from Manassas. Now, if you're coming from the southwest, which is where we were coming from, and you're coming northeast into the then ADIZ, that heading of roughly northeast is going to take you, if you miss Manassas, it's going to take you right into the heart of downtown Washington. And I knew I didn't want to be there.
Certainly did not.
With no communication, no transponder. I thought I would have been clearly identified as a threat and as a target.
Your decision then was what?
So I knew the area well. I had flown a lot. As I said, I learned to fly at Martin State Airport. I had been to Gaithersburg a number of times. I'd been to BWI. I don't think I yet landed at Dulles, but I've since been to Dulles many times. But I knew the area. I've been to Frederick. And so I told my passenger, David, the attorney, I said, David, here's a flashlight. Let's get out the POH, the operating handbook, and let's start reading some emergency checklists and see if we can't get the alternator to come back online and do some things. I should also mention that I had with me a handheld transceiver, a handheld radio. And I remember getting the weather in Fayetteville on that handheld radio. So it was working fine in Fayetteville. Well, when we lost the panel avionics, I brought up the handheld and turned it on, and the batteries were dead. And I had no replacement batteries.
There is nothing worse than the backup failing.
Yeah. So the only good news was great VMC weather. And I knew that if I turned to the northwest, there were a number of airports up in that area, places like Frederick, Leesburg, others. And I said to David, I said, well, we'll just look for a rotating beacon and we'll go there and make the best of it. And he said, well, should we land on a highway, on a road? I said, no. That's a little risky. We have plenty of fuel. Fuel was not an issue. Engine was running fine. Weather was fine. We're going to find a VMC airport with a beacon, and we're going to land.
An uncontrolled field at that point, at that hour, would probably not have much traffic in it, and I'm sure that boosted your confidence somewhat.
It did, because I thought, well, that's we'll stay away from the traffic. Certainly don't want to go hunting for places like Dulles or BWI. That doesn't sound like a good plan. Let's go find it. And I knew there were uncontrolled fields. off to our left and within 20 or 30 miles.
You had a backup radio that failed. Did you have a battery-powered or handheld GPS in the airplane at that point, or were you strictly VOR navigation from the panel?
I had a GPS in the panel, but I had no backup GPS. I had not yet purchased a handheld GPS. I now fly with three of them. And I fly with at least three or four flashlights and two handheld radios. So I did learn some things that night, Rob. I did learn a few things.
You were using then paper charts in addition to what the GPS had?
Yeah, this was the pre-iPad era. So we had only paper charts. And the paper charts confirmed my memory that, yes, there in the direction we were heading, there were airports. And it was only a few minutes until we actually saw a rotating beacon in the distance. And I said to David, I said, that's where we're going. We're going to go today. He said, well, what airport is that? I said, I have no idea. But that's where we're going.
You didn't have an idea of what the local altimeter setting was. You didn't have an idea of what the frequency, the common traffic advisory frequency for whatever that rotating beacon's airport was. So you were really, as VMC as it was, you were still in the blind.
We were in the blind. And then it finally occurred to me, I said, oh, I don't have any electronics. I have no power. How am I going to turn on the runway lights?
Oh, my gosh.
And of course, I couldn't communicate because I had no power, so my communications radios were not functioning. So I knew this was going to be a Nordo approach to this airport. But it took me a few minutes to think, maybe I'm going to have to land without runway lights. But then there's more to this story that kind of helps with that.
What about gear extension?
So that's one of the things. Fortunately, in the Sierra, the gear extension is relatively trivial and straightforward. You put the gear lever in the down position, and down between the pilot's feet, there's a little trap door. And you open the trap door, and there's a hydraulic valve. In the hydraulic system, the plumbing for the hydraulics, you simply turn this valve 90 degrees, and it relieves the hydraulic pressure and the gear falls down by gravity. So then David asked me, he said, well, how do we know the gear's down?
Exactly. You have no three in the green.
We're just going to have to take it on faith that the gear is down. Now, I could sense that the gear was down because in the Sierra, when the gear went down, you could really sense a lot of drag. And so the whole configuration of the airplane changed. And I was fairly confident that our gear was down, but I had to take that on faith. There was no way I knew that the gear was down.
You're however many miles away from a rotating beacon,
yes,
with runways that you cannot see, with no way of communicating to anybody, or what happened next?
Well, what happened next was a miracle. So I'm flying along, and now I would estimate we're within 10 miles of this rotating beacon. And down below our, and we were still at about 3,000 feet. And that was the other thing. I had David shine the flashlight on the altimeter. And, you know, the altimeter was still working. It didn't need electricity to work. So we were at 3,000 feet. And because we had, Potomac Approach had been descending us in preparation for the approach. So we weren't up at the 7,000 feet where we had been. We were down. And I knew the terrain in that area from years of flying in that area. And I knew there wasn't anything we were going to hit over there.
Especially if you could see the rotating beacon at some distance meant there was not a significant amount of terrain that might be an obstacle for you.
Yes, and any towers that might be there, you know, we would have been able to see the red beacon lights on the towers.
Sure.
But then here's the miracle that happened. So I'm approaching this runway. I'm about this flashing beacon, the rotating beacon, and I'm about 10 miles away. And now I see a red light and an airplane moving below our altitude. And he's moving from my right to my left. And I thought, oh, somebody's out here and they must be doing night practice landings. And then as we got closer, the runway lights were on. I thought, this is wonderful. That guy is turning on the runway lights and I'll just keep an eye on him. I can certainly see his rotating beacon. We'll just avoid each other. We'll play good citizen. Even though I can't talk to him, we'll just avoid him. Okay, that's a plan.
You're going to be number two for the airport.
We'll be number two. So I continued to go to the airport. I knew what the local elevation was. I descended to what I remembered was a appropriate pattern altitude in that area. And then the runway lights went off. And I thought, oh, maybe
had you been able to figure out what the heading was when you saw the runway lights on? Did you do the math?
I did the math, and it looked like the runway was northwest southeast runway. So I pretty much had an idea how we were going to set up to do the landing. So I thought, oh my, maybe he's landed and, you know, he's going to parking. And then about a minute later, the lights came back on. And I said, well, he must still be out there. So I kept looking, and I didn't see that there was going to be any conflict. And now the next thing that occurs to me is, I've got to land with no landing light. And I hadn't done that in a while. I'd done it somewhere in my training, probably in my commercial or instrument training, but I hadn't done it recently. And I thought, oh my, am I going to be able to land this airplane with no landing light?
Had you figured out what the airport was at that point?
No, no.
So I don't even know how long the runway is.
I don't know any, but as we got closer, I could judge from the number of runway lights that it was a fairly long runway. I was pretty confident that it was long enough to handle my Sierra. And Sierra lands in, you know, 12, 1300 feet. It's an easy airplane to land. So we set up, did a left base, turned on the final. I saw the runway lights, and I thought, well, the only way I'm going to know I'm getting close to the ground is those runway lights are going to start to spread out. They're going to start to expand. So I will watch the expansion, and I'll be very attentive to my airspeed and make sure I do my GUMPS check and get everything, because this is a, you know, retractable, it is a complex airplane. Got to make sure everything's, you know, by the book. And we got set up, and down we come, and those runway lights spread out. And Rob, by God's grace, I probably made one of the best landings I've ever made, day or night.
Okay. Before I stand here and applaud next to my microphone, what about flaps? Were they electric flaps, or do you have a Johnson bar in that?
No, there's a big old handle you had to tug.
Okay.
Three
All
times.
Right, so manual flaps. So your speeds were spot on. You could get the right V speeds for your landing.
Yes. And again, you know, the airspeed indicator and the altimeter, not electric dependent. And so, and David was being very dutiful about shining the light over there so I could read those. And we just came down and settled right. I mean, it was literally a squeaker. I probably haven't made a landing like that in the 20 years since. And then I'm on the ground, and now I've got no landing light. I've got no taxi light. Now I've got a taxi in the dark. Well, it's doable, but it's challenging. But fortunately, we followed the blue lights and found our way, and we could see there was a building. There was a lit up building, a fairly sizable building, off to our right as we exited the runway. And it was very lit up. I said, well, we'll just taxi over there. And we'll, you know, shut it down over there and find out where we are. So I taxied over, found what looked to be a reasonable place to park, shut it down, opened the door, and I could see there was a woman standing outside this very well lit up building, and she looked like she was smoking a cigarette. So I kept my distance, but I got out.
On the ramp.
And so I got out, and, you know, this is a lowly airplane. So I stood in the wing. I said, ma'am, where are we? And she must have thought, I have lost my mind. And she said, I'm sure she did. She said, well, you're in Leesburg, Virginia. I said, oh, good old JYL. I know where we are. And then she said, and we are very disappointed. I said, man, I just landed this airplane with no electronics in the dark, and you're disappointed? And she said, yes, we wanted to see the F-16s. Well,
so obviously, air traffic control had continued to track you as a primary target and knew exactly where you were.
Yes, and this building happened to be the flight service station at Leesburg.
There you go.
So they knew exactly what was going on. And that's why she said we were disappointed. Well, then the next big surprise of the night, I turn to my right and I hear this thump, 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 thump. And here comes this large green and white U.S. Coast Guard Black Hawk helicopter.
Oh, my goodness.
And he landed, I would say, about 100 feet from my airplane. And I said to David, I said, uh-oh, we're probably in some kind of trouble here. So the helicopter lands, and these very young, virile, handsome young men came out of the helicopter in their olive drab flight suits, and they started striding over to me, and they looked at me, and they said, were you flying that airplane? And I looked at David, and I said, no, he was flying.
Oh, no, you didn't say that. You didn't say that.
I think I did.
Oh, gosh.
And then one of these guys reaches up. He had a pocket on his sleeve, and he reached into his pocket, and I thought, oh, he's going for the handcuffs. This is not going to be good. And he pulled out a cell phone, and he said, Potomac Approach would like to speak with you.
I bet.
So I got on the phone, and I said, hello, this is Potomac Approach. Were you flying 1939 Lima? Yes, sir. And are you safely on the ground at Leesburg? Yes, sir, I am. And I said, may I ask you a question? He said, of course. I said, is there going to be a lot of paperwork?
Oh, no.
And he said, no, we just wanted to make sure you were safely on the ground.
How about
and,
that?
And he said, the reason we wanted to know is, of course, your safety. But while all this was transpiring, we had a ground stop on all the traffic at Washington National, Dulles, and BWI.
Because of you.
Because of me. And then it became obvious what had happened, that when they lost radio contact with me, they launched this Coast Guard helicopter, and that was the red light I saw in the distance turning on the runway lights.
For you.
For me. He was actually tracking me, and he turned on the lights for me. By God's grace. And so then after Potomac Approach thanked me and very appreciative that I was on the ground and said, we can now release the ground stop, the two young men got back in the Black Hawk and off they went. And Rob, that was the end of it. There was no paperwork. There was nothing else to do, nothing to report. And that was the end of it.
Oh, Victor. Well, tell you what, that's an incredible story. And it's such a good ending in spite of the fact that, well, we'll find out more. Let's take a break. We'll come back and learn what you learned about flying from that. We'll be right back. Avemco is the only aircraft insurance company that lets you call them directly. In fact, they want you to call them. They love talking about airplanes, and if you've got a squawk with your insurance company, even if it's with Avemco, they want to hear about it. It's that direct one-on-one personal contact that sets Avemco apart. Visit avemco.com/flying or call them today at 800-338-8705. Say you're an I Learned About Flying from That listener, and you'll save 5% on your annual premium. Now, back to I Laughed. We're back with Victor Vogel, retired doctor, multi-thousand-hour pilot who had the unthinkable happen in the worst of possible places. Victor, what did you learn about flying from that flight?
Well, I learned quite a few things. First, carry more than one set of batteries for your handheld radio.
Okay.
And carry a handheld GPS so that you have a means of navigating if you should lose your ability to communicate. That's now a lot easier in the days of GPS on iPads and with remote receivers and ADS-B in and so forth. That's now something I do. To remain proficient in things like that we don't often think about, like landing at night without the landing light. I just last week did a number of night landings for currency, but I didn't do any with the light off. I should probably do that again. To have available things like flashlights, which we did have, and I now carry more, and to be ready to do things like the emergency checklist. We went through and did the things that we tried to do to bring the alternator back online, to restore power to the battery and so forth. And to have a plan, always have a contingency plan if things should fail. The what ifs, where are we going to go if we, for whatever reason, can't get to our destination?
This could have been a significant issue had you not been so familiar with the ADIZ, or now the CIFRA, and where the gateways are and all of those things, to go into those areas without incurring the wrath of the DC Air National Guard F-16.
Yeah, and I think if I had tried to find, and you know, finding Manassas at night is a real challenge because there's so many lights in the metropolitan area, and I just knew it was not a good idea to attempt to find that airport nearby. And that's a tower controlled field, and it's fairly busy. I mean, it gets a little quieter by 9 o'clock at night, but it's still, there could have been some significant traffic, and they've got business jets and they've got flight school, and it's a busy airport. So I thought the better part of valor was to head off in another direction outside the ADIZ to an area where that would be less traffic. And as you said, an area I knew, so it would be less likely we'd encounter difficulties.
It's interesting that I've talked with some other pilots who have said, east of the Mississippi, there are a lot of airports, but you get out farther west and some of those, the plethora of rotating beacons that we see in the eastern part of the country don't exist until you get right out to the west coast.
Yeah, yeah. And although in the middle of the country, and I've flown over it many, many times, there are many fields that are flat, and there are many long straight roads, although I'm not sure landing on a road at night with no lights, I'm not sure that's the best idea because wires and towers might be unseeable. And now I fly a Cirrus, so the option of the Cirrus, which is unlikely to have a complete electrical failure because we have two batteries and two alternators.
Right.
We've got the parachute. So the parachute is really the safety net if all else fails. But I think those are the lessons that I learned, to have lots of backups, lots of options, lots of alternates, and to keep your head in an emergency, to do things like don't forget to lower the gear manually and do the best you can with the situation, because the airplane was still flyable. There's nothing wrong with the airplane. The airplane flew very well. So there was no reason we couldn't fly to a destination. It's just that, you know, the way we approached and handled it. And thank goodness there was little traffic at the airport that night. And thank goodness we found an airport which wasn't busy and didn't have a control tower. But I had another electrical failure years ago and landed at Martin State with no radio and got light gun signals from the tower. And, you know, that can be done as well. But I thought it was best to head to an airport where it was likely not controlled.
Those are a lot of good lessons, Victor. Any other lessons about what you learned about flying from that?
No, I think those are the major ones, other than just remaining proficient in all the things, in night currency, and instrument currency, and dealing with emergencies. One of the things I do now when I fly along is I read emergency checklists. When I'm droning along for 2 or 3 hours at straight and level flight, I get out the POH and just read the emergency checklist so they're very familiar.
Good idea. All good ideas and a great outcome and a fun story. The miracle that you talk about with the Coast Guard Black Hawk helicopter, the HH-60, that's pretty impressive that those guys had the foresight to turn on the lights for you.
Well, I hope I remembered to thank them because
you didn't tell them who was flying the airplane.
they're turning on the lights was very, very important to the successful outcome of this emergency. It really
Indeed.
Was.
Victor Vogel, thanks for your story, and thanks so much for being on I Laughed.
Thanks for having me, Robert. It was fun.
Just a note regarding that alternator failure. Victor told me that it was caused by a spontaneously fractured armature due to age, not any kind of trauma. It was great to have him as a guest. Keep those stories coming. I'm a bit behind in responding, but I've been receiving good I Laughed incidents from very nice contributors. My email is rob@flying.media. rob@flying.media. The I Laughed theme and commercial instrumental music for the podcast was written and performed by Rob Pothorf. Lisa DeFries is the executive producer of I Laughed, and Julie Boatman is editor-in-chief of Flying Magazine. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.